Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. There are many countries around the world that are as much nations of immigrants as the United States, yet few of them have taken as much pride as the United States in declaring themselves to be nations of immigrants. In this hour, in part, we'll be talking about why it is that this has become so important to the way that Americans think about themselves and their country. And the guest for the program is an historian of immigration, Donna Gavacha. She's director of the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota and has written a good deal about these issues. She is here visiting the campus to give a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock on this very subject about immigration and the notion of the nation of identity, what's that, what that is all about, what it means to Americans. She'll be giving her talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum. That's on South Gregory in Urbana. And this is in connection with an initiative looking at history and policy of immigration, sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study. Also, some other departments have contributed to it as well. So this is an event that's free and open to anyone who is interested. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you'd like to hear her talk this afternoon at 4, you're certainly welcome to attend. Questions here on the program are also welcome. All we ask about, all we ask of people who call in is just, well, if you can keep your questions brief, that's good. We'll get in as many people as possible that way. But of course, anyone's welcome to call. 333-9455, toll free 800-22-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
It seems that indeed the United States is unique in the way that it has embraced this notion of the nation of immigrants and being a very important part of American identity. I guess I can't really think of any other country that would so have embraced the idea that their national motto would be something like out of many, one. Now, it's imperfect maybe in many ways, but that's something that we really – that we have told ourselves that story for a long time.
Yeah. Actually, occasionally Canada or Australia also refers to itself as a nation of immigrants. And France occasionally refers to itself as a nation of immigration. Hmm. But you're right. The United States foregrounds that, really, in its discussion of its nationhood. Although, ironically, the idea of out of many one refers to the unification of the states into one at the time of the creation of an independent and federal form of government.
And at the same time, though, I'm sure that when I use that phrase and when I hear it and when I think about it, and I expect a lot of people, that what they're really going to grab onto is this idea of people.
Absolutely.
Many people, one nation.
Absolutely. And when I started thinking about how other nations might claim this label for themselves but decide not to do it, of course I began to wonder, well, has the United States always thought of itself this way? Does it, in fact, go back to the formation of an independent nation at the time of the American Revolution? I think many Americans assume that this is a very old idea, that the United States is a nation of immigrants. So one of the things I've actually done as part of the research on this project is to try to find early uses of the term nation of immigrants and what it meant to people at the time that it was first used. And I found a couple of things, which I can say a few words about maybe.
Sure, yeah.
The first thing that I discovered and that I'm still puzzling over and I find quite fascinating is that really until the 1870s and 1880s, Americans didn't always refer to the people coming into their country as immigrants. They called them emigrants with an E. Hmm. And this is so counterintuitive to us. Why would the United States refer to people coming in as emigrants when we, you know, we would think, well, it's the people going out of the United States who would be emigrants, not the people coming in. But it was really the standard phrase for the newcomer through much of the 19th century, the emigrant coming to the United States. And in fact, if you look at a picture of Castle Garden, which was the place in New York Harbor that processed people coming off of ships prior to the building of Ellis Island in the 1890s, it was called the Emigrant Depot, or there's a door that was marked the entry door from the ships was marked for emigrants only. And again, that's not for people going out of the United States, people coming in. So, I mean, it's literally impossible. People did not use the phrase nation of immigrants during this period when the newcomers were instead called emigrants. I don't really have a good explanation yet, although I've been working on several possibilities, for what the use of the term emigrant meant, why that was preferred to immigrant. Emigrant was a positive phrase. It was associated with westward movement. It was associated with settlement of the land. It was associated throughout the British Empire, and it's used also in Canada and Australia, not just the United States, for settlers into frontier areas. So it's associated with, in positive ways, with empire building and settlement in rural areas, not just in the U.S., but in Canada and Australia as well. The word immigrant comes into use much later in the century, and it's a negative phrase, ironically. Immigrant was first most heavily associated with Irish wage earners in the 1830s. They were more likely to be called immigrants rather than emigrants, but it's especially associated with the arrival of the Chinese. The Chinese were always called immigrants. They were never called emigrants. And as we move into the 1880s and 1890s, the word immigrant begins to replace the word emigrant for discussions of the newcomers. Immigrants are wage earners. They settle in cities, not in the countryside. And in most of the early uses of the phrase immigrant, the reference is either to policy, to regulation and restriction, or it's to the negative consequences of what we today call immigration. So again, it's hard to think of a celebratory nation of immigrants as long as the word immigrant is a negative phrase. And that seems to be true into the middle years of the 20th century, that immigration is a word that makes Americans a little nervous. It's the language of restriction. It's usually used by people who want to shut the door rather than open it and celebrate it. So those are the first two things I found. The third thing I would point to, and we could talk about more if you're interested, or we can go somewhere else with it, is I actually started looking for uses of the phrase nation of immigrants. And, of course, it's hard to do this. There's massive and massive and massive numbers of texts, but one of the things that's helped me in my search is the digitization of texts, right? Searchable texts. You can use a Boolean kind of search for newspapers, for example. There's large archives now. You can use Google Books. Think about, right? It's searchable. So I've started looking in digitized archives for early uses of the term nation of immigrants. And so far, the best documented early uses of this term date from 1879, 1880, the 1880s and 1890s. And when it's used, it's not used in the ways we associate today, right? When we say the United States is a nation of immigrants today, or it is and it always has been a nation of immigrants, these are phrases you frequently hear. It's a celebration. It's a celebration of American economic development from which the immigrants benefited. It's a celebration of the political freedoms that immigrants acquired when coming to the U.S. It has a very positive and celebratory feel now. That was not the case in the early uses of the term. The first use of the term so far that I have from 1879 refers to the previous immigrants from Europe in contrast to the Asians entering China. In fact, it's used for the first time by a very well-known advocate of restrictions on Chinese immigration. And although there's somewhat more positive early examples, it's in that sense that the past, the nation attracted good people. But we have to rethink the nation of immigrants because of the quality of the newcomers coming in from Asia and from Southern and Eastern Europe. And so it's really people who want to restrict, to create more regulation and lower the numbers of immigration who actually celebrate the past. And my favorite example of this is from a New England reformer of the early 1890s, who at a meeting of social welfare workers says something like, sure, this has been a nation of immigrants, but for the 1,000 years before those immigrants came here, they were already practicing democracy, and goes on then to talk about the immigrants of the 1890s, who were from what Americans regarded as political dictatorships, monarchies, uncivilized parts of the world, Southern and Eastern Europe. They were Catholics. They were Jews. They were non-Christians from Asia. They were people who were under the thumb of emperors and kings. They had no capacity for democracy. And this woman, who used the phrase Nation of Immigrants, really used it as a way to say, that's over now. Now we have to restrict. And this earlier negative history of the phrase, associated as it was with the desire to restrict, is really quite different from the way we use the term today. And the phrase doesn't get widely used really until after John F. Kennedy in 1958 or 59 writes a campaign book for his presidential campaign called Nation of Immigrants. And then after 1960, the positive and celebratory use of the phrase takes off. But it's a very recent development. And its positive use dates from the time when, of course, the actual number and proportion of immigrants in the United States had sunk to its all-time low of 5%. So there's a very paradoxical and ironic history of this phrase that's worth thinking about when we use it.
Yeah. Well, and I guess and what that points to is that in as much as this whole notion, this Nation of Immigrants notion is part of the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves, in fact, if you look at history over time, we have not always felt comfortable with newcomers, and it also might have a little bit of something to do with who they were, what they looked like, where they came from. So then having said all that, the kind of conversation that's going on right now about immigration, particularly about illegal immigration, people coming from Spanish-speaking countries, Mexico and Latin America, this is not new.
Well, no. There's parts of this story. I get asked two questions frequently. The first question is, of course, is the hostility to immigrants unprecedented?
No.
And the answer to that is very clearly no. Every time that the numbers of immigrants, foreigners, have risen in the 1790s, when the fear was of Irish and French revolutionaries coming from Europe and bringing their bad ideas with them or their rebellious ideas with them, again in the 1840s and 50s, when concern about the impoverished Irish and especially Catholic Irish was intense and led to demands for their regulation and especially prohibitions against Catholics serving in political office. Again, in the 1880s, concerns about Catholics and Jews, which we would today call anti-Semitic, very openly expressed in the United States, through the exclusion of the Chinese beginning in the 1880s and then the restriction of migrations from Southern and Eastern Europe in the 1920s. Hostility to foreigners is nothing new. Some people even hypothesize that xenophobia, the fear of the outsider, is a universal human trait. So that part of it, no, there's nothing new if Americans are worried about the impact of the large recent influx of foreigners into the United States. So that's the first question. No, there's nothing new. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be concerned about issues of cultural conflict. As an historian, I also tend to say, well, over 30, 60, and 90 years, those fears usually diminish, and it's the groups that were feared 50 years ago are the groups that are celebrated today. And I suspect that's going to happen again over the course of the next 50 years. The second question, however, is always, oh, but they were legal immigrants. Mm-hmm. And what's new about today's debate is that today's immigrants that raise concerns are illegals. They're here without permission. And there's a number of ways to tackle a question like that one. First of all, there were what we would today call illegal immigrants in the past, but the laws that they violated were not typically the laws of the United States. They were the laws of the countries that they left. Countries like Russia, the Empire of Russia, and for many years the Empire of China as well, forbade their citizens to leave. And if you read the stories of many, especially Jews, who left Russia, there's often a clandestine, there's a secret crossing of a border, hidden in a cart of potatoes, you may have read stories like that. So there were illegal immigrants who violated the laws of their home country, German men who left and Italian men who left without serving, doing their military service. They weren't supposed to leave if they hadn't done their military service. So there are illegal immigrants. But there also were, beginning in the 1880s, and even in larger numbers by the 1920s and 30s, illegal immigrants in the past. Every piece of legislation to restrict migration of any sort has generated illegal entry. If, for example, when the United States told Chinese workers that they were no longer welcome, some of them pretended to be merchants or the sons of merchants. That would be considered today illegal immigration, I guess. Some of them simply entered the United States from Canada or Mexico because the borders there were not patrolled. Once Southern and Eastern European immigration was restricted in the 1920s, people from those parts of the world started jumping ship. There's a whole population of Greek and Italians who entered the United States as, you know, stowaways and Navy men who jumped ship in New York Harbor. And they, too, start entering through the Caribbean, through Mexico, and through Canada, where there are no restrictions on entry, at least the numbers of entries, until more recently. So there were illegal immigrants, and there were many acts passed from the 1930s until the 1950s to regularize the status of people who entered without permission, often on petition from their families, their ethnic communities, to their congressmen. So there were illegal immigrants in the past. The issue of illegality and is a very intense one today, although it's probably not as uppermost in the minds of most voters when they go into the voting booth, as one might suspect. Something like 37% of the American population says this is a really huge problem. Vast majorities of people in the United States would like to see the number of so-called illegal immigrants diminished. But that doesn't mean they all want to build a wall. There's very intense debates on what the best way is to diminish the number of illegals. And people who don't have documentation or who enter the United States legally and then do illegal things like taking a job when they're not supposed to or overstaying their visa. That's about 40% of people, actually, who fall within this category of illegal immigration. They didn't cross the border without permission. They just got here and they've done things that their visas don't allow them to do, or they've overstayed their visas. There's no agreement, actually, among this large group of Americans who would like to see those numbers diminish. Some people actually, small numbers, actually say, well, we should have a regulated but more open border, a border where everyone is inspected and where the federal agencies control visas more tightly, you know, by making sure that people who come in on a short-term visa leave again. Then there are people who want to build fences. And then there's a wide range of policies in between, which call for, depending on your political perspectives, pathways to residency and a green card and citizenship, or what their opponents of these policies call amnesty. So there's a wide range of solutions to the so-called problem of illegality. One of the things that most disturbs me about this conversation, and one of the reasons as a scholar I get angry when asked about illegality while talking about other dimensions of immigration, is that when I talk to people, I often discover they will say, I'm not opposed to illegal immigrants. I'm only, you know, I like immigrants. I just don't like the illegals. But then we'll say something like, I go to my public health, department, and I see these illegals in there getting free medical care. And I think, how do they know they're illegal? There's no, we don't have a letter pasted on, you know, an I pasted on forehead or arm or a star on our chest that says I. But many people see a Mexican, alas, and think illegal, when in fact most Mexicans in the United States are here legally. And many Mexican Americans have been here for generations at a time. And this is a critique of the discussion of illegality that comes out of the Latino community in particular, because the illegal immigrant is imagined by most Americans to be a Spanish speaker from either Mexico or Central America. And in fact, within the category of illegals, we have people from every part of the world. Illegal populations in New York City tend to overstay visas. They come from Europe, the Caribbean, and Asia, not just from Mexico and Central America. But when people talk about seeing illegality, they're usually talking about a Mexico origin, or what they think of as a brown person or a person who might have roots in Mexico.
I got a call I want to bring in here, and for people who might have tuned in the last little bit, I want to introduce again our guest, Donna Gabacha. She's professor of history at University of Minnesota, where she also heads the
Immigration
History Research Center. Yes, indeed. And she is here visiting the campus to give a talk on this very subject, really talking about the notion of America as a nation of immigrants, what that is, what that means, where it has come from. She'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus at the Spurlock Museum, Knight Auditorium on South Gregory. It's open to anybody who would like to attend. And questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I've got a caller here in up in St. Charles on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, good topic.
Hi.
You know, I do have a problem. There's a couple of issues I have to pick a bone with you. I know. Having grown up in Southern California, I live out here now. I've been out here for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to all these, you know, things saying, well, they're not really taking stuff from us. They are. I'm a retired paramedic, and I could tell you that about over half of the rescues I went on, and this is a known fact because there's no identification, there's no driver's license, a lot of the car wrecks that I went on were illegal immigrants. Now, who's paying for the cost? Now, and this is what I'm getting. We have to pay out of our own pockets locally, whether it be the state or the county of that department. It's going throughout the whole country where you have to fork out money. You can't just let them die and bleed to death.
Yeah, right? That's
so
right.
Nobody has, and this goes for anybody. This is not just, you know, Hispanics. This is Polish, Lithuanian, anything. You know, it isn't like it was 50 years ago or 60 years ago. Modern times does not dictate we give out freebies anymore, and that's the problem. And there is a lot of discrepancies in what you're talking about as far as people telling you and giving you the right facts. I know that it's hard to get information as far as going to a hospital or going to a doctor or something. How do you know if they're illegal or not? You don't. But
I can attest
to this, that a lot of the landscaping jobs out there are, a lot of them are all illegals because in the wintertime around here, up here in the Midwest, they go home to Mexico. They have said it. I've worked for a guy that, you know, that has them. They are illegal, and you're proud of it. And the other thing that burns me up about it is they know English language, but they don't want anybody to know because it would give them, it's like lowering themselves down to us. Because if they start talking English, then they have to deal with this, you know, and if somebody were to come up and argue with them on this issue that we're talking about, you know, they'd have to deal with it.
Obviously
landscapers are, you know, people that hire them are taking advantage of them. Okay.
Yeah.
There's
lots of points to raise here. Can I respond to a few of them maybe? First of all, you point to a very important fact, and that is that in fact the costs of medical care for poor people, whether legal or illegal, whether foreign-born or native-born, are paid at the state and local level in the United States. And that's a relatively recent development. Beginning in the 1970s, the federal government began to get out of the business of supporting certain kinds of social services. And they've always, until very recently, stayed out of the business of providing public schooling. So there are costs associated with education and health in particular that are being paid by the states and the local levels with diminishing amounts of support from the federal government, whereas immigration policy, as I'm sure you know, has at least for 100 years or a bit more than 100 years been a federal prerogative. So part of the intensity of the debate about illegality is about exactly the issue that the caller has raised, that the solution to and immigration, to solutions to problems of immigration and the setting of immigration policy is done at the federal level, whereas the costs of paying for the uninsured and the cost of all public education is done at the local level. I know more about how that plays out in public school systems than I do in ambulances. But yes, in a population where 30% of the immigrants or half of the immigrants don't have proper documentation, you are going to see them in ambulances alongside other people. And a certain amount of that is going to be paid for by taxpayers. The thing that I always like to bring into that conversation is that those people pay taxes. One of the most common myths about undocumented workers in particular is that they don't pay taxes. Most of them pay taxes through their rent. They pay sales taxes on everything they purchase in the United States. A third of undocumented workers, or no, I'm sorry, 15% of undocumented workers own homes. So they're paying real estate taxes. And unless we take into account the tax revenue that the foreign-born generate, we're not coming up with an accurate assessment of what they cost us, the American taxpayer. And that's just this reshaping of the policy debates that I would like to see. No one denies that there are certain economic sectors in the United States that depend very heavily on workers without documentation. Agriculture has long been an employer of seasonal workers who come, who go back, who come, who go back. As we have made the border harder to cross, for good reasons, perhaps, it's harder for those people to return on a seasonal basis because they don't know if they'll get back in again. But agriculture has definitely long employed people without proper visas and documentation. So has construction and landscaping. So has the restaurant and the hotel industry. And the big debate here is who to punish for the employment. Many Americans would prefer to punish employers rather than workers. Others want to punish the workers themselves. And that is not usually the focus of a very clear debate. The passions rise very high on both sides of this issue. Who is the criminal? Who should be charged with the act of illegal employment? Is it the employer who bears the responsibility? Is it the worker himself who bears the responsibility? I would love to see that debated openly, but I don't always hear that as the two policy choices. Both employers and former immigrant workers who now have their papers are voters. Both of them have influence within political parties, and the result has not been much clarity. And I don't actually see that clarity yet, at least in the presidential campaigns. But those are the choices. Do you want to give visas to workers? Do you want to give visas to family members? Do you want to punish employers? Or do you want to punish the people seeking a job? Unfortunately, most Americans, and I think our caller is among them, doesn't see working as a crime. It's hard to imagine, you know, somebody who's traveled a long distance to take a job as a bad person. But there is illegality involved here, and who bears the responsibility and pays the price for that violation of the law is what's at the center of the debates and should be at the center of the
debates. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have two other people now who are waiting, and I'm already well past the midpoint, so I hope you won't mind if I go on. Just very quickly, given the fact that this has been a very hot-button subject here in the United States within the past, I don't know, couple of years, does it surprise you that it seems that so far in this year's presidential contest in the primaries with the various candidates talking about various issues, that it seems that there hasn't really been very much discussion about this particular issue?
I think actually that pattern has a very long history in the United States. In none of these periods of time that I mentioned earlier did discussions and hot, heated debates about immigration determine the outcome of presidential elections. And there was a whole article in the Sunday New York Times about this, that where a wide variety of specialists from both sociology and history agreed, really, that even when the debates are hot and passions are high, this is an issue that does not drive voters' choices when they go into the ballot box. Let's look at this year's primary season. The candidates who were most involved in slinging challenges to their opponents about illegality and illegal immigration are now all out of the running. Romney, Giuliani, Huckabee, to name but a few, were accusing their opponents of being soft on immigration, insisting that they would be tough on the border. There was discussions of deportations and imprisonment and detention. All of those people have lost out to John McCain. John McCain was the sponsor of last summer's failed Immigration Reform Act. If you go to John McCain's web page and read his policy on immigration, it is all about border control, not about deportation, not about detention. He does not go anywhere near the issue of what's to be done with people already living here. He will face that if he becomes president once he's there. But the hot button issue, as it was raised by political candidates, did them no good. The most moderate of the candidates in the Republican Party is now going to be the Republican candidate. Yeah. And if you look at the Democrats, the difference between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton on immigration, again, go to their webpage. They all have descriptions of what their immigration policy. They basically agree that U.S. immigration policy should be driven by the humane value of keeping families together. That's not a statement about illegality. It's not a concrete proposal of any sort. But there's not much difference in the philosophy being expressed there.
Let's talk with some other callers here. We'll go next to someone in Champaign, and this is line one.
Yes.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I listened very carefully to the gentleman who was the first caller, and I think it's definitely a perspective issue. I have two friends in the Southern California area, and I consider them both liberal, spiritually and liberal people, and one of them has Scandinavian ancestry and was complaining about the tremendous cross-cultural diversity of Southern California, especially the Asian population. And she said, oh, it's just, you know, not working for the rest of us. And I asked her, when did her grandparents come to this country, or her great-grandparents? And it turns out that they came in about 1890. They were Scandinavian. And, you know, and I reminded her of this, and she did pause and think, oh, well, that's true. You know, here I am living an upper-middle-class life based on my immigrant great-grandparents coming to this country. And I talked to another woman who herself was an immigrant, legal. Her whole family was legal. Her children were born here, and they are legal. And she is Israeli. And she once mentioned to me that California is full of Israelis who have overstayed their visas. You know, she said, there must be, you know, a million people who have overstayed, Israelis who have overstayed. And she thought that was perfectly reasonable. She herself was an Israeli, and Israeli born. And she complained about the people who come in from Mexico, and you can't hardly hear a word of English in Southern California. And so I tried to gently remind her as well, pointing out that my parents, my grandmother and mother, were immigrants to this country in 1920. And I think, you know, we just forget that, you know, we weren't all born in this country. You know, our ancestors were not all born in this country, unless, of course, they're the Native American population. And I was so glad to hear your answer to the gentleman who moved here from Southern California. And excuse me, I think the people who are talking about deportation, you know, just don't have their heads on straight. And I am also reminded that about 20 years ago, the restaurant, American Restaurant Association, I think that's the trade association, knew that they had to employ immigrants. And so they wanted very easy immigration laws because they knew right there that, you know, a lot of the restaurant workers were from Mexico, Central America, South America, and you know, I'm just kind of appalled at the people in my country. I'm going to let you go.
I appreciate again the comments. The caller raised a number of good points.
I could talk for an hour and a half on that. Yeah. There's so many good, important and difficult issues raised here. First of all, one of the problems I think of constantly referring to the United States in a celebratory fashion as the nation of immigrants is that it seems to imply that there was no cultural conflict between foreigners, between differing religious groups, and between differing ethnic and racial and language groups in the past. And that's just not the case. The United States was in the throes of very harsh cultural, ethno-religious battles between Catholics and Protestants, between Irish and German and New Englanders in the 1840s and 1850s, between Catholics and Protestants and Jews, Southern and Eastern Europeans, Finns and working class peoples in the Iron Range. This was true 100 years ago, 110 years ago. Cultural diversity is difficult. Cross-cultural communication is difficult. It's terrifying to many people. It's understandable that it's terrifying. These conflicts, which always exist during periods of immigration, do not work themselves out over 4-year spans, which are what dictate American elections. They don't work themselves out in a decade. The people who study cultural conflict and accommodation usually talk in terms of generations, 30 years at a time, 60 years at a time, 90 years. 3 generations is 90 years. That's how long it can take. Now, it's reasonable, I think, to debate how much cultural conflict nations or local communities can tolerate. But let me remind you that in New York City in 1910, in Chicago in 1910, the proportion foreign-born was just as high, if not higher, than it is in L.A. or many American cities today. This is not new. It hurts. It changes over time. But it's hard to tell a politician to wait a generation. And it's hard to tell an American voter to wait a generation. Politically, we want solutions within 4 years, or if we're talking about Senate races, 6-year periods. That doesn't work very well as solutions to the issues of cultural conflict that you've raised. So that's one set of points. The other set of points has to do with working. And this is a combination of things I've been thinking about as I listened to this caller and the previous one. Most Americans do value work. And the immigrant has, for the last 50 or 60 years, often stood as a symbol for a positive work ethic in this country. Many employers do seek foreign-born workers, in part because they will often work for slightly lower wages. And the problem of illegality is largely a result of the fact that there is no way, and let me repeat that, no way for a blue-collar worker to get a green card. There's, I believe, 5,000. Some people have suggested 10, but my reading is 5,000 visas available to people to do blue-collar jobs in the U.S. And yet half of the fields of work that the U.S. Department of Labor predict are going to grow most rapidly over the next two decades are what we would call blue-collar jobs. So I'm not very sympathetic when I hear people say, why don't they get in line and wait like everyone else so they can get a visa and be legal? The sad fact of our immigration policy and our immigration system is that there is no line for hardworking, poor, and poorly educated people. And all of the debates about immigration reform that spark interest are about increasing the numbers of visas for either seasonal or temporary workers as a kind of guest worker, get them in and send them home again, mm-hmm. or they are about recruiting highly skilled and highly educated workers, usually in tech, bio, and tech, bio, and healthcare fields. Until we have an immigration system that somehow acknowledges the ongoing demand in the United States for work in construction and work in the health in the hotel and restaurant industry and work in agriculture, we're not going to solve the problem of illegality. That's my personal opinion as a voter, although I think it is an opinion that's informed by a lot of research and reading on the topic.
We have about 6 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Donna Gabacha. She's professor of history at University of Minnesota, where she specializes in, among other things, U.S. immigration and labor history. And questions are welcome. We do have a couple of people here, and we'll try to get at least one, if not both, in the time that remains. And the next person in line is in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I was wondering if there's ever been any studies on how much undocumented immigrants actually save Americans money, because I think we need to take an honest look in the mirror and realize that if you look at how much they save every farm grower to Walmart to guy who needs his lawn trimmed, and then you subtract the education costs and the health care costs, which I think good Christians would want to provide, but that's another issue, that they actually do save most, I would say, probably middle class, well, everyone, money, and that, you know, well, anyway, you can speak to that.
That's a very interesting observation. I wrote a short piece once on the web about what would happen if the ICE showed up at our dinner table to kind of purloin the illegally produced meats from the meat processing plants that they raided last year. There's debates among economists about the impact of immigrant workers generally and the impact of illegal immigrants in particular on American consumers. There's lots of good arguments, but not yet much hard data on how much it saves Americans as consumers. But it seems obvious that if there's a slight downward trend on wages as a result of rapid increases of all kinds of immigration, legal or illegal, there's also a downward pressure on consumer prices. And very few Americans think of themselves as consumers and their impact as consumers on this topic. But there is clearly an influence there. Many of us directly and indirectly hire people without documentation ourselves. Most of the raids are made on large employers, usually in fields and in factories. But a very important part of the employment of people without documents is in small businesses like contracting of construction and landscaping, and especially in parts of the Southwest and California, one of the largest places of employment of women without documents is in the personal homes and households of Americans who are very directly paying them. And I don't know, I know of some controversial cases where candidates for political office have been fingered for employing women in those capacities. But I don't know of too many people who would like, too many housewives or personal private families would like to have the ICE show up and do a raid, but if they went raiding, there'd be lots of homes invaded. And I think those are two issues we need to keep in mind when we talk about this issue too. A downward pressure on wages always means an equally downward pressure on prices, and consumers do benefit in some way.
So has there actually not really been a study or good studies done about the impact of undocumented workers on the American economy in terms of the labor that they provide and you said, as you said before, the taxes that they pay, and just the fact that they also are spending money? They have to buy food and clothes and gasoline and everything else.
There is a small scholarly literature on each of these issues. The largest one is from labor economists who have reached very differing conclusions about the impact of the employment of immigrants generally and undocumented workers in particular on wages. Some of them show no difference. Some of them show up to 3% declines in wages for unskilled workers. It varies from city to city. It varies from region to region. Like most scholarly literatures, it's very highly focused and it's hard to generalize from it, but there is disagreement among labor economists. There are regional and state studies that attempt to estimate the taxes paid, the middle-class jobs created by immigrant consumers of all sorts. There's some studies of the revival of decaying urban neighborhoods when large numbers of foreigners begin to make homes and open businesses there. There are studies of immigrants as business owners and the amount of value they generate for the economy. Economists who work historically generally agree that the long-term consequences of immigration economically are positive. The debate is always about the short term and the local consequences. And on that, there's kind of disagreements, actually, among specialists.
We'll see if we get one more caller here. And this is line 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a little bit different view about immigration. And I think the problem is that the more people that come here to live in this country, the more demand that everyone puts on the resources of the land. And we chop down all the trees for construction and toilet paper. We or the cattle overgraze all the land, and so we can have meat. The farmers overplow to plant soybeans, and then people go into the pristine wilderness to destroy it, mining for oil and gas and coal and gold and silver and copper. And I just think that nobody thinks that there's any end to this, to the resources, and I think one of these days that we're not going to have a support system we need because the land won't be in condition to support the population.
I think that a lot of people would make this point one thing that it's reasonable to talk about is what's the sustainable level of population for the United States, and then how do we think about how many people we're going to let in, and as a part of figuring out how many people we can.
Yeah, I think all of those, every point that the callers have raised are reasonable points for discussion and debate. I have heard arguments, many people in zero population growth, for example, people who are concerned about sustainability. My perspective on that is that one needs to look at kind of the global distribution and use of resources in terms of density worldwide. The United States, Canada, and Australia, which draw large numbers of immigrants, are still relatively underpopulated. But yes, as especially with the coming oil crisis, which we can anticipate, all of these issues are going to be rethought. Nevertheless, very dense areas of the world are still attracting migrants. Northern Europe is probably about 5 to 6 times more densely settled than even the more heavily settled parts of the United States. They're still drawing migrants, although it's really quite interesting that in today's world, parts of what we usually think of as the third world are also now drawing migrants. You know, one of the things I'll talk about in my talk this afternoon is that some really interesting and unexpected corners of the world have very high proportions of foreigners living on their national territories. And so when I think about the issue that the last caller raised, I tend to think about it in global terms, not in national terms, because the circuit, at least under the under the current geopolitical arrangement worldwide, resources and people and goods are all circulating across national boundaries, not just being generated within them.
We are at the point we're going to have to stop, and I'm sure that on future programs with other guests, we'll continue to talk about these same things. Do you think, in fact, that for the foreseeable future, we're going to be wrestling with the same issues and essentially we could have the same conversation a year from now or 5 years from now?
I think it's quite possible we'll be having the same conversation a year from now. 5 years from now, I'd say 50-50.
So you think that somehow it will settle down or will sort of settle into the reality of it?
Historically, debates have usually persisted over 2 to 3 generations. Big changes in policies have occurred every 50 to 60 years. So it's quite possible to have ups and downs in debates over long periods of time. With real changes in policy only coming at the very end of 30 years of conversation. So it's quite likely you and I will be dead by the time this thing gets resolved. Not a pleasant prospect, but that's a historian's perspective.
Well, our guest, Donna Gbacha, is professor of history at University of Minnesota. She is here visiting the campus to give a talk as part of an initiative sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study, looking at history and policy of immigration. She'll be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus. This is in the Spurlock Museum Knight Auditorium on South Gregory, and anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. In addition to being a professor of history at Minnesota, she is also director of the Immigration History Research Center there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, in this race for the White House that's now going on, both Republican and Democratic candidates have voiced their admiration for Ronald Reagan. He was also invoked by George W. Bush in his campaign for the presidency in the year 2000. Why does Reagan's popularity endure? Has Bush's tenure in office resembled the Reagan Revolution? Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn talks with Carl Cannon. He is the co-author of the book Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy. That's on the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. Up in the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about severe weather. It's very wintry now, but it won't be that long before we'll be talking about thunderstorms and tornadoes. And the guest in the next hour will be our meteorologist, Ed Kieser. We'll talk about that. Support for the program comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. We'll break for an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Basedifer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right to the prices. We're in Kansas City. July wheat is at $11.26, up one. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is at $11.07. It's up 11. May at $11.13 is up 8. July, $10.64, up 17. March corn trading at $5.52, down 5. May, $5.63, down 4. July, $5.75, and it is now $5.75 and a quarter, down 3 3/4. December at $5.74, and it is now $5.74 and a half, down 2 3/4. March beans at $14.54.